These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. And because of the weak laws, they come in fast. We get them, we release them, we get them again, we bring them out. It's crazy.
That was the President of the United States speaking to local officials and law enforcement in California on Wednesday. On Thursday, President Trump said he was specifically referring to members of the MS-13 gang.
We have laws that are laughed at on immigration. So when the MS-13 comes in, when the other gang members come into our country, I refer to them as animals. And guess what? I always will.
I always will. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today, a look at what happens when we take our fellow human beings and make them something else, something subhuman. Wednesday's meeting wasn't the first time the president used this type of language.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you.
I was reading one of these animals was caught.
I won't call them monsters because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
I know it doesn't sound nice, but not everything is nice.
So to use an animalistic language to characterize them is really placing them in an alien biological category. And it's an attempt to represent them as not meriting the sorts of attitudes that we have to other human beings.
David Livingstone Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and author of Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. And he says that what President Trump is doing with this rhetoric has been happening for centuries in this country and for millennia around the world. And guess what? There are consequences.
When you refer to a subportion of a racialized group using this sort of language, what listeners tend to do, who are responsive to that sort of derogatory rhetoric, is to generalize. So even if he specifically had in mind, and for some reason didn't make clear, that he was referring to violent members of a particular gang, the fact is that many of his listeners will almost automatically extend this to, in general, to undocumented Latino immigrants and probably actually even documented Latino immigrants.
Let's dive a little deeper into the psychology behind this. This is essentially, we're talking about dehumanization, and this idea when you dehumanize is really embedded in a hierarchy, a sort of racial hierarchy, right?
Yes, a racial hierarchy and a biological hierarchy. So human beings tend to think of the world as arranged in a hierarchy. It's a very, very old idea going back. Well, officially, it's supposed to go back to late antiquity, but I think it's actually much more ancient and much more widespread. The idea that there are degrees of intrinsic value. We human beings modestly place ourselves very high on this hierarchy. And what that means is that it's impermissible for us to treat human beings in ways that we feel free to treat other sorts of creatures. This is a kind of a ranking. Now, within the category of the human, and this probably, well, this is an old idea as well, but it really picked up steam in the age of colonialism and the peak of the transatlantic slave trade, which would be the 18th century. The idea that within the human category, there are subranks as well. As this scheme was set up formally by white European men, they again modestly placed themselves at the top of the human hierarchy, you know, the paragon of humanity.
Quite a convenient placement, if you will.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And all these other racialized groups were placed at lower ranks. At the very bottom were, depending upon who was writing, sub-Saharan Africans or Native Americans.
And there was also the idea that they're, I mean, essentially saying that these people are not even human.
Yeah, so that takes it a little bit further. So when people get racialized, they're regarded as a different kind of human being, a different and inferior kind of human being. I don't think race is ever a neutral descriptive notion. Racialization arises out of conflict, exploitation, and oppression of human groups. So built into this sort of racial language are implicit ideas of superiority and inferiority. When you dehumanize people, you just push them one step further out of the category of the human entirely and into the twilight zone of subhumanity.
I want to also talk about some historical examples. We briefly touched on the transatlantic slave trade, but let's talk a little bit about how language was used to dehumanize different folks throughout the course of history. We have the slave trade, we have the Rwandan genocide, Cambodia. I'd love for you to help take us through some of these.
The use of dehumanizing language is very old. Some people see it as a product of modernity. It's not. We can find references to it in the writings of ancient China, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. Go back to ancient Greece, a very influential thesis was Aristotle's thesis of natural slavery. I mean, Aristotle basically argued that anyone who is not an aristocratic Greek male was defective. They were what he called natural slaves. And natural slaves were not fully rational. They weren't quite like cattle because they were capable of sort of what he referred to as a sort of passive rationality. But he thought they benefited from being enslaved so they could vicariously benefit from the superior civility of their masters. And this was an idea that was invoked again and again by the Spanish colonists in the Caribbean and what is now Latin America, by European slave masters in North America, and so on. The idea that these people are defective, not quite like livestock, but not quite like human beings either. After the Civil War and the collapse of efforts to secure the rights of African Americans in the South, in the United States, black men in particular were dehumanized and demonized. If you look at the rhetoric around lynching, you find consistently black men referred to as beasts, bloodthirsty animals, crazed. There is one example where the victim was said to be torn apart in a frenzy of guerrilla-like fury. This sort of language was very, very common. If we look at wartime propaganda, we find the same thing. Enemies are described as subhuman creatures. During World War II, we certainly did that to the Japanese and used overtly exterminationist language, comparing them with lice that need to be exterminated. And the Japanese did the same to us, by the way. If you look at each of these wars, you much more often than not find this sort of language. But of course, genocide is the real hotbed of dehumanizing rhetoric. And if we go through all of the genocides of the 20th century, we find this kind of language. The group of people to be exterminated are described either as traditionally unclean creatures, lice, parasites, leeches, things of this nature, disease organisms, or as dangerous bloodthirsty predators.
And we're seeing right now there is obviously a lot of political support, at least from the administration, is really pushing this notion of who's allowed in, who's allowed out. How dangerous is this? How dangerous are these comments, these consistent comments from not only the administration, but also from average everyday people? We're seeing so many videos online right now with people just yelling at people for being who they are. Do you fear that it's going to go beyond viral videos and into more serious consequences?
Well, I'm sure it already has. I'm sure that there are hate crimes that are, let's say, empowered by this sort of stuff. But I don't think this is anything novel. What's happened in the current regime is that attitudes that were previously regarded as socially unacceptable to express publicly have now been given permission to. This was part of Trump's appeal, that he sort of gave permission for people to be authentic. In this case, the authenticity is a sort of authenticity that one would hope did not exist, but it nonetheless does exist. And it will exist until white America really is prepared to come to grips with its national crimes, its historic national crimes. And I'm afraid we're nowhere near that point.
David Livingstone Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and the author of Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Now, some of you feel differently from Professor Smith.
Oh my gosh, I love it that you guys are defending MS-13, those poor defenseless gang members. Wow.
And we got this message from Brenda on Facebook. The gentlemen in MS-13 who gang-raped my friend's 13-year-old daughter are animals. Either way, words clearly matter. What goes too far? How has language been used against your community or to stereotype your group?
Hi, this is Savita calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I'm part of an immigrant community that conventionally has been referred to in a positive light. Those of us from India and other Asian Americans were described by President Ronald Reagan as quote-unquote model minorities. This is still offensive and unacceptable, but not as abhorrent as what the current president has said.
Aloha aina. This is Pete Shimazaki, doctor, a second-generation Okinawan, calling from Moanalua and Honolulu in Hawaii. We Okinawans have been referred by Japanese government agents as savages still, while U.S. military continues to occupy and dominate our tiny islands for over 7 decades now. Policies or even being invisible in terms of respect and power can often be harsher than words.
This is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. Yes, as a Muslim, I get to hear how I'm a good Muslim compared to the majority of my 1 billion brothers and sisters who must be quote-unquote terrorists or radicalized simply because of something so random as in which country they were born.
This is M.J.J. Cashman. I'm calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. My family's been dealing with this sort of nonsense since the turn of the last century. My great-aunt Katie, who was quite the stalwart Kerry gal, used to say, no Irish need apply. Whoever wrote it well. The same is on the gates of hell. Some things never change.
Thanks so much to our listeners for those calls. And y para nuestra audiencia que habla español, que sepan que aquí en The Takeaway también lo hablamos. Si queremos comunicar con ustedes, llámenos al 877-869-8253 o tuiteanos @TheTakeaway, @TanzinaVega.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, I'm Isabel Angel, the line producer for the show, and we've got a question for you. Have you ever bought a toy for your kids that was supposed to be educational? Did it actually end up working, or was it just like totally annoying? I remember when I was a kid, it was all about Hooked on Phonics, and I don't know if that machine ever really taught any kid how to read. So if you've got a story, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also leave us a voice memo by going to thetakeaway.org/mytake, and you might hear your story on Monday's show.
Does Facebook know your race or your religion or your voting habits?
Cambridge Analytica offered voter disengagement services in the United States, and there are internal documents that I have seen that make reference to this tactic. My understanding was that this was targeted at African American voters.
That was Cambridge Analytica whistleblower Christopher Wiley testifying this week before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the tactics used in the lead-up to the 2016 election, and how that company attempted to manipulate African Americans and other voters through digital advertising. I spoke with Bari Williams. She's a tech industry legal and operations executive and the former lead counsel for Facebook. And Leah Wright-Reger, a historian and assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, who says that what we're seeing is an old tactic with a new and more dangerous technological twist.
Efforts to depress Black turnout are as old as apple pie, right? That ever since African Americans have had the right to vote, there have been attempts to stop them from voting. What's different here, though, and this is, I think, where the information warfare comes in, is that there are technological differences that change the landscape of how you can reach people, how you can depress turnout, And part of what's going on is that there is no transparency about how that works. The landscape of social media is politicized, and that's something that we have to talk about.
Bari, I'm curious to hear what you think on this, because a lot of the allegations that we're hearing is that, you know, there were Russian hackers who were trying to incite racial animus in the United States, and, you know, whether or not that actually had an impact. But what we're talking about here is tactics that were employed to specifically discourage Black Americans from voting, correct?
That's exactly what it was. And to Leah's point is this is not a new tactic. Now you just have technology which enables it to be far more expansive and more effective and more covert, which is kind of a trifecta in a really bad way. So you have issues around bots, you have issues around false accounts. And in some of these instances with the larger social networks, because they are so large, you have billions of users, you're not going to be as diligent in terms of scoping out and weeding out those fake accounts or bots or anything of that sort. So it's really about preventative measures more so than it is about corrective.
But what exactly was happening here? What were Black voters seeing or not seeing on Facebook?
So let's say that you are a Black man and you typically tend to vote Democratic, but maybe you've been posting on certain pages saying that you're not really motivated in 2016. Based off of those interactions and understanding that you may not be motivated, understanding where you live and if that is a state that may be a turning point, we may want to target certain ads to you to depress the vote, to say, just stay home. Not necessarily we don't want you to vote for this person, but just stay home, period.
Was this sort of a more direct approach to say, okay, these districts have already been redrawn, which has obviously been a problem so far, and we're going to target Black Americans in those districts?
This is the part where data and transparency really matter, because we still don't have a clear enough picture of who exactly was targeted and how it worked with, say, voter suppression efforts or gerrymandered districts or areas like this. We know a little bit, for example, that Black men in Ohio, in certain areas of Ohio, were targeted. And these were Black men who had some issues with Hillary Clinton, but also who had been enthusiastic voters for Barack Obama. We know that Haitian Americans in Little Haiti in Miami were also targeted in these kind of niche campaigns. But part of the, you know, sophistication of some of these techniques is that they were dark. So we actually don't know who was targeted and how, although that is beginning to come out.
Bari, I'm curious also, you've noted that in part the lack of diversity within companies like Facebook, tech companies, is part of what contributes to this problem. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of it. So you have issues of lack of board diversity. So you don't have anyone that is lobbying for the general population of users in a larger stance. So if you have lack of board diversity, you don't have anyone representing those views. Now, in the case of Facebook, they appointed Ken Chenault, I think, in February, which is great. But it also kind of gives me pause, because you had Deborah Lee appointed to the Twitter board. You had Linda Johnson Rice at Tesla. So there's kind of like people essentially throwing Black directors at some of these tech companies because they know that they'll get heat if they don't. I think that that's very relevant. But more importantly is how you treat the employees that are already inside. If you are locking people out of the C-suite, locking people out of director level and above roles, they're not in the rooms where those decisions are being made. And so if you're relying upon majority folks to relay their concerns or messages, oftentimes they're not going to make it into that room. And I feel as if perhaps there had been greater diversity at a higher level, or maybe those voices would have been amplified, some of these things could have been stemmed before they really were huge issues to this point.
And so one of the interesting things about social media has been this idea that social media serves a democratizing function. But what we're actually learning is that without kind of some kind of regulation, without some kind of oversight, or without people that are actually invested in the communities that use these platforms, that these things can be, you know, weaponized to push back against democracy.
Yeah, democracy is not equitable. And I think Leah Leah and I pretty much cover that. The problem is, if you're looking at this from a standpoint of ads, it's pay to play. So if I don't have any money, I can't amplify my voice. The other issue I would implore people to be critical of is you have these platforms now talking about using AI to detect hate speech and to take down certain content. And that's great in theory, except when you dig deeper and you try to understand what are the parameters as to how you define hate speech. Who's at the table when you're determining what is hate speech? Do they have the cultural competency, not just in America, but in all of the various countries in which these platforms operate, to say, this is hate speech in Cambodia, this is hate speech in Rwanda? If you don't have that cultural competency, how can you make those decisions?
And how are you defining the limits of discourse in many ways, right?
Exactly. And why do you think that that is appropriate? And so it's really going to be imperative for all of us to ask those hard questions and hold their feet to the fire.
Critical conversation for these very important times. Leah, Bari, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Bari Williams is a tech industry executive and former lead counsel for Facebook, and Leah Wright-Rigger is a historian and assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. When it comes to wealth in this country, one thing's clear. Your elected officials in Congress definitely have it. The estimated cumulative wealth of all current members of Congress as of this February was at least $2.43 billion. That's billion with a B. And an analysis by Roll Call found the median net worth of all members of Congress was $511,000. That's five times what the average American household has. And half of that net worth is in the hands of just 12 members of Congress. And as we've been hearing from you, at least some wealth is usually necessary to run for any office.
Hi, this is David Vanden from Dallas, Texas. Although I have worked on political campaigns in the past, and have been a community organizer, there is no way I could financially afford to take off from work to undertake such an endeavor, especially with having student loan debt.
My name is Lauren Brock. I am running for state legislature of Oklahoma. I know for me and my husband, it's been difficult for me to run because I'm disabled and do not currently have a job. And I know if my husband did not have a job to take care of us, there's no way I would be able to run for office.
But what are the consequences of that? And what does it mean for how we deal with the wealth inequalities that we've been talking about all this week? Alex Hurdle Fernandez has been studying the relationship between wealth and politics, and he's a professor of public affairs at Columbia University, and he joins me now.
I'm so glad to be here.
Alex, so the big question is, I guess we'll start off, can poor people run for office in the United States?
That's a great question, and it really gets to the heart of the issue of whether or not the inequalities of wealth and income that we have in our society seep into our political system and reinforce themselves. I think there are big obstacles, we know from political science research, to running for office, and even more so if you are a low-income person. Not only is there the cost of the campaign itself, having to pay for campaign staff and advertising, which can be very expensive in some seats, but there's also the cost of having to forego your job. Campaigning and serving in office is a full-time job, and if you have to give up your job, that's lost income. That's money that you can't be getting from other sources.
So what impact does that have? Because we're in a moment, we've been talking about wealth and inequality all week on the show. We're hearing from Americans all over the country who are struggling to make ends meet, who are struggling to pay rent, who have little to zero wealth. What impact does it have when our Congress is so much wealthier than the average everyday American?
Increasing research in political science points out that who you are in Congress makes a big difference in the sort of bills that you vote for and even propose. And it turns out that members of Congress that are wealthier, that come from white-collar backgrounds, who have never worked a manual job in their lives, are less likely to support the sort of redistributive economic policies like a higher minimum wage, more progressive taxes, or more generous social benefits like unemployment insurance that working-class Americans might need. So that suggests that we're in a bit of a vicious cycle. The less representative that Congress is of working class America, the less likely it is to pursue policies that would help working class Americans.
I'm speaking with Alex Hurdle Fernandez, professor of public affairs at Columbia University, and we're talking about wealth and politics in America. Now, we Recently, a couple, say about a month ago, there was an article in about Stacey Abrams, who's running for office. And she said, as a black woman, she said, you know, I'm $200,000 in debt. That should not prevent me from running for office. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. And I think it's worth pulling out and thinking about how politics runs in other countries. And we make it uniquely difficult in some ways to run for office, given the cost of campaigning and the fact that you have to give up your job. There was a great investigative piece a few weeks ago in The Intercept that pointed out how the Democrats' main House campaign committee was picking candidates to back in the upcoming 2018 cycle by asking them to go through their phone book and point out exactly who would help them raise, you know, the first $150,000 if they had to right then on the spot. And it's understandable why a party committee might want to pick candidates who would be embedded in these networks that have a lot of potential donors, but it also means you're screening out a lot of candidates that don't have those connections. And the question is, as a society, do we want to create a money primary or a money obstacle that prevents certain classes of people from being even eligible to run for office?
So what are some solutions going forward? What about, you know, because as you mentioned, there is this interest now in people running for office. I think we're seeing this resurgence of Americans who are saying, you know, I'm not happy with the way things are going, regardless of what side of the political spectrum they're on, wanting to get involved. But as we know, there's also this gigantic inequality gap in America. So what are the solutions, you think?
The solutions to getting a more representative Congress and state legislatures and city councils is, one, to have the interest and enthusiasm from candidates, but two, over the longer term, I think we need reforms that lower these obstacles to running for office. Those could be things like political scholarships. You know, you could imagine either private donors or even the government creating scholarships for low-income folks to start their campaigns. And then finally, we need civic organizations that can seek out these folks in the first place. One of the main reasons why many individuals don't think about running for office is nobody asks them. And it used to be historically that we had strong private sector labor unions that encouraged the formation of grassroots leaders in local communities and supported them in their electoral campaigns. And I think the decline of the labor movement is one important reason why we've seen a decline in working class candidates. So anything that could revive the labor movement or support other forms of worker organization could help working class folks get into government.
Alex Hertel Fernandez is a professor of public affairs at Columbia University. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Hey there, just a quick interruption. The Takeaway does not exist without your voice. So we want to hear your thoughts. Got a comment about that last story? Or maybe the next one? Tell us on the Takeaway Facebook page. Or you can leave a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks.
The big royal wedding between Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle is upon us. On Saturday, the two will tie the knot at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. As a biracial and divorced woman, Markle is certainly shaking things up, marrying into a family that's not exactly known for its diversity. British comedian Gina Yashere has been following all of the developments. Gina, why do we care so much about this wedding in the United States? Please tell us.
I don't know. I think it's the royal, there's a mystique around it. I mean, the closest that you guys have had to a royal family is the Kennedys, right?
Pretty much.
Right, whereas we've got, the royal family's got that tradition, it dates back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. There's a mystique around the whole royal family thing. I don't think the Brits care that much. I mean, maybe there'll be a few, but, you know, most of us are like, all right.
I feel like we're more excited than they are, for sure. And, I mean, Obviously there's the Meghan Markle element to that,
Yes. The fact that she's American, she's not white.
Shocking. Don't tell anyone.
She's American. Exactly. She's black. Well, she's mixed race. And biracial, that's the word.
She's biracial.
She's biracial, yeah. American, and an actress.
That's right.
And so you can go back on YouTube and go, oh, look, that's her doing normal stuff before she became, well, apparently she's going to be a duchess, not a princess.
Oh, well, then that's,
apparently. You,
I don't even know the difference between
Neither
the
do
two.
I.
But they
I'm
seem
British
pretty
and
important.
I don't know.
There you go.
It's just semantics.
So, I'm sure the royal family wouldn't think so. So how symbolic is this wedding when it comes to race in Britain?
Oh, it's extremely. I mean, she is the first acknowledged person of color in the royal family.
Ooh,
because
there's something there, though. What do you mean?
Queen Charlotte Sophia, who was Queen Victoria's grandmother, she was a mulatto, it was the word that they, she was. It was never publicly sort of admitted, but she was. There were lots of paintings of her, and they were always talking about how they had to try and thin her nose out and make her look a little bit more acceptable in paintings and stuff. But she was a descendant of an African, a Moor, Portuguese Moor. So, yeah, Meghan Markle is not the first black woman in the royal family. She's the first acknowledged black woman.
Now, wasn't there a story recently about someone in the royal family showed up with a really offensive pin that sort of... What's up with that?
Princess,
what happened there?
That's Princess Michael of Kent, if I remember rightly. She's always been... They used to call her the pushy princess in that she's kind of on the peripheral of the royal family, but she uses all the benefits and everything that she can use out of her connection to the royal family, she uses. So she's always been that person. And yeah, she's always been a little bit racist and a little saying things that you're not supposed to say. And she turns up with a brooch with a basically look like the gollywog from the jam jars back in the day. She basically turned up with a brooch with that on it. With a black face on it. I mean, why would you do that when you're going to meet Meghan? I'm not even thinking it was insensitive. I think it was probably purposely done. She probably thought it was funny. She's saying she wears it all the time. She had no idea, but yeah.
Is that the tone? I mean, I think, you know, we have our own pretty fraught history that we're still sort of dealing with about race in the United States. What's the tone there? Right now among Britons and among black Britons in particular?
The racism in the UK is just as potent as it is out here. It's just done differently. They're a bit subtler about it. Oh, they used to be a lot subtler about it until Brexit, and then it completely unearthed all the xenophobia and hatred that Britons had been burying for a long time.
Had a similar thing happen
with Trump.
Here,
exactly,
yeah.
It's the same thing. Trump, Brexit, very similar time, very similar thing. It was like the tide pulled out and then we got to see everything that's under the ocean. There was a lot of racist outcry and the newspapers were feeding into it with their dog whistling terms. You know, I don't know if you saw some of the headlines, you know, Meghan Markle from the hood, almost straight out of Compton. I was like, she was never anywhere near Compton. What are you talking about? Her mother has dreadlocks. Oh my God, no. Her mother lets her hair grow out of her head the natural way it grows. Oh my God, what? Scandal.
Are you going to get up early and watch the wedding yourself on Saturday? Why or why not?
Absolutely not. I hate weddings at the best of times. I don't even want to go to my own family's weddings. So I'm not going to be using my spare time to watch the wedding of two people I have no real connection or interest.
Not even to see the dress, or you just see it online
later? I have no. Yeah, obviously, it'll be all over. There'll be memes all over Instagram the next day. So I'll just go on Instagram and get my news the next day. I don't care about the dress. I'm very happy for them both and it's very lovely, but I don't really care.
I mean, they are a very photogenic couple.
They're very, yeah, well, yeah, they are. They're a good-looking couple. I mean, Harry got lucky with the looks in that family because William, he was such a cute kid. I don't know what happened. Are you going to leave that in?
British comedian Gina Yashere is a regular contributor to The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and her latest comedy special is currently streaming on Netflix.
It's a pretty good special. Very funny.
I love it.
Say so myself.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Gina.
Thanks for having me.
I've come here to say one magic word to you. Cheeseburger.
What's the magic word?
Just say the magic word.
You didn't say the magic word.
Abracadabra.
Abra.
Abracadabra. Abracadabra, Holmes.
What's the magic word?
Open sesame.
Matu, ferrata, nectar. Okay.
What is the magic word, Mr. Beckman? Please.
Somehow, some way, we all made it. And that means movies with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm good. Week two here. You know, we're going strong. Really looking forward to the weekend and maybe seeing some of these movies. So let's start out. Deadpool 2. I haven't seen Deadpool 1. I know. Sorry. Let's take a quick listen to a clip.
Hi there.
Stay back, or Justin Bieber dies.
Justin Bieber, he called you Justin Bieber.
Oh, hold on, wait.
Okay, let's not do whatever that is.
okay? Let's just talk. It's Russell, right?
Fire Fist.
Fire Fist. Ooh, that's a great name. Where does it burn? Just the fist or all the way up to the elbow?
Rafer.
Well, Tanzina, you're the only person who hasn't seen the original Deadpool, and I'm the only person who didn't like it.
Oh, my. Okay, so we're in some kind of club here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is the sequel. It's Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. If you're not familiar with him, I would describe him as the bad Santa of superheroes. He's the guy who smokes, drinks, curses, shoots you when you're unarmed. He's that kind of sort of good, bad guy.
I could hang out with this guy.
All right.
Yeah,
well, maybe you'll like him.
All right.
You know, you've got Josh Brolin playing the villain this time, who just played the villain in the last Avengers film. He's here playing a villain named Cable. I think my problem with the Deadpool movies is that I keep wanting them to be subversive, but Deadpool can't really be subversive because he is part of the Marvel universe. So really, he's just kind of messing around inside this playground, which is not that interesting to me. But I guess this movie works okay as an action comedy. You know, there's a new superhero named Domino, whose superpower is that she's lucky, which I thought was kind of interesting and funny. I'd like to see more of her. I just wish these movies had a little more teeth and a little bit less of the pop culture, Justin Bieber, aren't superheroes funny? Don't we all know how superhero movies operate? And let's make some jokes about it. Not that great for me personally.
And so do you think for those who saw the first version of this film, they'll be fans of the second? Or
I think Deadpool is like Duran Duran at this point. I think that he just come out on stage and do anything and everybody would be happy. So I think this is going to be a big hit.
Awesome. Our second movie is Book Club, and it's directed by Bill Holderman, and it stars Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, and Candace Bergen. And let's take a quick listen to a clip.
This book made me realize that it's been quite a while since we, you know.
As in weeks?
Like maybe six.
6 weeks?
Months.
Oh my God, I thought you guys were like rabbits.
We are. If rabbits took a ton of Benadryl and made a chastity pact.
Oh, my God, we have to put a stop to this.
Oh, come on. I mean, if women our age were meant to have sex, God wouldn't do what he does to our bodies.
Whoa. Well, speak for yourself.
On that note, Rafer.
Well, I don't need to tell you what they're talking about, but I will tell you that the book that they're talking about is 50 Shades of Grey. That's what they've chosen for their book club selection. It sort of restarts their libidos, and they find out that it's never too late for romance and sex, even in late life. This is a pretty creaky film script-wise. I think, as you can tell there, every innuendo, every sexual metaphor you've ever heard is in this movie. There are really no new ones. And that's too bad, because what a great cast. You didn't mention Mary Steenburgen,
right,
who's also in the cast. And the male cast is great, too. Don Johnson, Richard Dreyfuss.
The Don Johnson?
The Don Johnson. And he's really good as Jane Fonda's boyfriend. I just wish that the script had been a little more smart. And I also don't believe these women would ever read 50 Shades of Grey. They're too smart for that.
I think you might be right. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
And now, a homecoming story. Emma and Lynn are Mexican-American sisters, and after their mother's sudden death, the sisters return to their East LA neighborhood to decide what to do with the building and the bar their mother left behind, which leads to a lot of conversations like this.
I'm pretty sure that half the tenants are still undocumented. Would they be able to rent anywhere else?
Like, you really care.
What kind of Mexican would I be if I didn't care?
That's from the new Starz series, Vida, the imagined story of two women coming home to family secrets, a changing neighborhood, and the people fighting to protect it. People like the young Latina activist, Marisol.
¿Qué pasa, mi raza? This is your girl, la pinche chinche. This is a manifesto, mi gente. So grab a pencil and take note, because this morning, I'm saying basta.
Those are the opening lines of Vida, a rallying cry against gentrification. Mexican-American playwright turned TV writer and showrunner Tanya Saracho created the show, which has an all-Latina and Latinx writing room, cast, and crew. Saracho told me her characters are wrestling with issues that come directly from the real world.
The big idea of this show was to write a show about gentrification.
gente, meaning the people. It's a play on the word.
I was going to say, explícame gentrification. Because,
gentrification.
Yes.
Gentrification is the gentrification of a Latinx space by an upwardly mobile Latinx or Latinx force. You know, it's a new term that's been, you know, thrown into the mainstream, but I guess it was along with chipster, Chicano hipster, and other terms.
Chipster? Wait a minute. We have a couple of words we're going to have to dissect here. So chipster is Chicano, a Chicano hipster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's, this world is steeped in that too. You know, artists come, the chipsters come, but I wanted us to take a look at how we are playing a part in this problem.
How Latinos are playing a part in their own gentrification.
Exactly. So gentrification. So the show is about that. The two sisters will become a gentifying force, because if they do anything to attract anybody else outside this neighborhood into their bar, they will become gentifiers, you know? And that's the debate. I don't know, you know, that's the debate. Is that what you need for this business to grow? Especially because the bar, as we find it, is sort of a haven for queer women in the neighborhood, which is not extremely popular. So it's niche, but it doesn't pay the bills.
So you said so many things that I want to go back to in what you just, there's like so many, I was taking notes furiously. So one of the things was the use of the word Latinx. And this is a word that has come into the current vocabulary for a lot of Latinos and Latinas. Tell us a little bit about this word. Do you use it personally? Is it something that we hear a lot about in the show itself?
Well, I come from the theater, and the theater follows academia, sort of, in the terminology. In, you know, the theater has sort of stopped using the word diversity, and we use inclusion, and then the mainstream is sort of catching up, or at least this industry. So Latinx I've been using for a while. It's a gender-inclusive term. It sort of wipes out the patriarchy because, you know, if we were in a room full of five women, five Latinas, and one Latino, we would still call everyone Latinos in that room, right? This sort of takes that away.
Now, the question is, can Latinos gentrify themselves out of their own communities? I grew up in a community that was that is now gentrified. I'm Latina. If I went back to my working class community, would I be considered a gentifier?
It depends. If you're displacing, then yes. If you are affecting the economy of that area in a certain way, let's say if you come and open up a juice bar, you know, and there were already jugo shops, you know, the jugos like always, but you open up a sort of like more chipstery, a high concept juice bar with more expensive juices, and it attracts a certain clientele, then yes. You would be a gentifier.
This is so complicated, though, because on the one hand, we want to see economic mobility and we want to keep things in the hands of certain folk. It's really a complicated issue. But there's also another layer to this, which is the show has depictions of queer intimacy and sex that we are not used to seeing on television necessarily.
Well, that's all by design, right? I wanted no glossy TV sex scenes, first of all, but also these girls have sexual agency. They're body positive. They're, you know, millennials with agency. And Latinas in a way that we haven't seen. Because usually we see Latinas that are sumisas and, you know, submissive and meek and scared.
Or the opposite. Or we're the
exactly.
opposite. We're just like
we are just
flaming balls of, you know, chiles. Like, yes.
Yeah. And I wanted these girls to be complicated and not just emotionally and as characters, but like in when it comes to their sex life. Emma is queer. I am queer. And sometimes I have to end up like defending my queerness and like lesbian bars or straight bars and be like, no, this is how I am queer. And Emma has been with trans people, with cis people, but what she is emotionally unavailable. Like intimacy is her big damage, you know? But in the show, you see her with a non-binary person. You see her with a woman. If we get a second season, you'll see her with more people, you know? Mm-hmm. And then Lynn. Lynn has figured out the age-old way to, like, to be some kind of, like, Western world Latina geisha to any and adapt to any male, usually white males, with money. So she doesn't have to work, which is not necessarily great, but like she has power over her sexuality in a way.
It also seems to fit into this very quote-unquote sex-positive moment that we're having right now, this sort of different depictions of your own sexual agency and versus what the expectations are, particularly in Latino communities where they can be very, very traditional and limiting in terms of, you know, particularly what women are allowed to do. I want to talk to you also about that, the folks that are putting this together. You have an all-Latino writing crew, Latinx is behind the camera. Tell us how this came together and why is that important?
Well, I think it happened the moment that Stars brought me in. Marta Fernandez is who brought me in. I think that matters. That name, you know, that we have someone on the inside. Now, she's Hispanic, of Spaniard parents, but it matters because I didn't have to go in there. And usually I go into these meetings and I have to be some kind of cultural ambassador. There was none of that. There was a shorthand already. In fact, Marta is the one who pitched me the notion of gentrification, and I had never heard of gentrification. Of course, it made sense instantly, but the conversation that engendered was just really interesting, you know, like that we had. But Marta had to have already been there. There was no teaching moment. In fact, she was teaching me, you know. But then right away, she was like, can you write a pilot about this? And I was like, yes. And then after that, it came the writers. And I knew always that I had dreamt of it since I got here. If I ever have a room, which I thought maybe if it happens in like 10, 12 years, you know, when they handed me the show, I only had been here 3 years. So I don't know.
Not bad.
I don't know. At first, it was like they handed me the keys to a really expensive car. And I'm like, I don't even have a license, you know.
I know the feeling.
But then here we are. And you just step up, you know, like that Hamilton song. You're not going to throw away your shot, you know.
Well, I have to say, I am not a chipster. But looking at the previews and what I've been able to see so far feels eerily, familiar to me. So thank you, Tanya. Tanya Saracho is a showrunner and creator of the new Star show, Vida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.